broadcast.
Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl.
No, my heart, oh my. Kia ora. Welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and today Karen joins me in the studio. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Alison.
Well, when we last spoke at our last show together a couple of weeks ago, we were definitely in the Joan zone, and we fangirled over Joan Didion's earlier works.
Yes, we did.
It was great. And but I was texting Karen at around that time, and I accidentally texted to you the words fangirdling, which was a bit of a Freudian slip, I thought. But then I kind of thought, you know what, a fangirdle perhaps is a fangirl of a certain era,
a certain era. Yes, yes, I like that.
A mature
a fangirl. Oh, different way than I put it. I was thinking fangirl of the 50s. I think that women of a certain age now are not tying themselves into girdles. I think they're actually speaking their minds, which is probably one of the few signs around that we can see in ways in which society has progressed in a positive way.
As it should be. Yeah, so anyway, since then, I've definitely been in the Jesmyn zone, and I'm speaking about the award-winning author Jesmyn Ward. And I think you've been a bit of a Jesmyn fangirl too, haven't
yes.
you?
Yes.
So anyway, she's just an amazing author.
One of the reasons why we chose
yes.
to do a show on Jesmyn.
That's right, because we're such fan
yes.
girls. So Jesmyn's an American novelist born in the late 70s, and she grew up in the Mississippi area. And she and her family were victims of Hurricane Katrina in 2011. And it's just such an awful story. When their house flooded, they set off in their car to try to get to a local church, but they became stranded in a field that happened to be owned by white people. And these white landowners refused to give the Ward family shelter in their home. It's just unbelievable. But eventually another white family took pity on them and gave them shelter. But it's just such an awful, awful experience for people.
Yeah, it is really terrible. But, you know, when we say divided society, when we say America is a divided society, this is what it means.
Yeah, yeah. So the book Salvage the Bones, it's an account of an African-American's family experience of Katrina. And so this family live in a fictional town in coastal rural Mississippi. And this fictional town is called Bois Sauvage, which translates to the wild woods. Now, the author plays with the words salvage, savage, sauvage and scavenge. It's a really poetic novel, and I think a lot of her writing is very, very much, it's got that beautiful poetry to it. So all these words, the salvage, the savage, etc., they all connect to this theme of survival that runs through the novel. The fictional family live in such desperate poverty. They're only just surviving, actually. The dad salvages scrap metal and the kids spend a lot of time in the woods looking for eggs. They even shoot squirrels and roast them over a fire. The mum's been dead for a long time. And the novel is narrated from the point of view of a 15-year-old girl called Esh. She's the only female in the family unit, and so she's vulnerable to predatory males in the neighbourhood. But throughout all of this, she's trying to be a mother figure to the family. And Esh is a reader. She finds solace in a book of mythology that is in the house. I think it's their only book. And she reads under the covers of her bed. So what I love about the book is that Jesmyn Ward weaves the legends of Jason and Deer and the Argonauts and the Golden Fleece right throughout the book. And I get the feeling that Esh is reading for her life. As I say, this poetic writing, she says, "My heart is a wounded bird, beating its wings against the cage of my ribs." It's so beautiful. And now when the hurricane hits and the floods come, she says that the rain is heavy, endless, and hits the roof in quick, crashing waves. And the family, you know, this is what we saw on the TV news at the time. They become stranded on the roof of their house. And I couldn't help thinking through all of this, there was no one in authority to help them. Where was the help?
Well, the help does need to be ordered from high up. And as I recall, George Bush was at a photo op when they came to him with the news of Hurricane Katrina, and he wouldn't even leave his photo op until he'd finished it to his satisfaction. And, you know, now we had Puerto Rico and Donald Trump ignoring totally, except for tossing paper towels at the crowds and lying about what help they'd been given. And, you know, it goes on. It's this instrumentalization of people's fear is the only thing that Trump is using.
Yeah.
Is using these bad news for, like the famous hurricane that didn't even strike Louisiana that he was saying would.
He drew it on
him. It's all political. It's terrible.
Absolutely
terrible.
Terrible. Yeah. So, probably a standout moment for me in the novel is that after the hurricane passes and Esh makes her way through absolute mountains of debris that are left behind, she finds a piece of coloured glass which has been marbled blue and white, and it's a remnant for her of the disaster. And I'll just read a tiny bit from the book. And she says, "I will tie the glass and stone with string, hang the shards above my bed so that they will flash in the dark and tell the story of Katrina, the mother that swept into the Gulf and slaughtered. Her chariot was a storm so great and black, the Greeks would say it was harnessed to dragons. She was the murderous mother who cut us to the bone but left us alive, left us naked and bewildered as wrinkled newborn babies, as blind puppies, as sun-starved newly hatched baby snakes. She left us to salvage. Katrina is the mother we will remember until the next mother with large, merciless hands committed to blood comes."
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
That's, I hate the word. I mean, I hate the word. I love the word, but because I love it, it's overused. There's so many people do. Mythic.
Mythic. Oh, mythic. Oh, I thought you were going to say wow.
No. I also love wow. Love and hate wow.
Yeah. So this book has had such an effect on me, and it's one that's definitely going to stay with me for quite some time. And it's just, you know, man's inhumanity to man and this desperation of people. One other thing, I noticed that she's so observational in her writing, and one observation that she makes is when the family are at the supermarket to buy essentials like batteries and bottled water as the hurricane is approaching. And she observes the white folk who are filling their shopping trolleys with massive amounts of stuff, sort of both essential and non-essential. And she notes, "The rich ones wear khakis and yacht club shirts. The others wear camouflage and deer prints." And I guess there she's describing a society that's divided along economic as well as racial lines, isn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, economic inequality, it's all the same thing, really, because economic inequality derives from discrimination in America. It's the lack of opportunities. And, you know, if I just want to mention here, because it's a classic that I've been meaning to read for years, and I finally did, and I really recommend it, which is another book about a hurricane, another book written by a black woman about a hurricane. This is Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Amazing title. Mm. So this one goes way back to 1937. It was a groundbreaking novel in terms of being a black novel and a feminist novel. And it's about the 1928 hurricane. Well, it's about many things, as all great novels are, but it takes place during the great 1928 hurricane in Florida, when, again, a lake overflowed and there was flooding and so on. And the title, this beautiful title, Their Eyes Were Watching God, comes from a scene where they're in their shanties and the 120-an-hour-mile winds have blown out the last light and they're in the dark, and it says they seemed to be staring at the dark, but their eyes were watching God. And she has the same thing. They escape. So in Hurricane Katrina, one of the terrible things was the messages that went out, there was a helpline to phone. And when you phoned the helpline, it told you how to get out of town on your car. It didn't mention how to get out on public transport. And black ownership of cars is a third of what it is for white people. And in the book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, they're walking, and they walk and walk and walk through these, you know, with the lake overflowing at their shoulders, to head for one high bridge where they know they'll be able to find safety. And then they get there, it's all full of white people who already knew how to get there, and there's no room for them, and they have to keep walking. They're holding onto cows to keep from being washed away. Really amazing.
It's just awful, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, I haven't, thank you for allowing me to put in the plug for the classic, which I finally read, back to Jessamyn Ward. Mm. I haven't read this book that you just mentioned, but I have read her next one, which is Men We Reaped, which you've read too, I believe.
Yes, yeah, I absolutely loved it.
I found it incredibly impressive. This is the book that says, this is what it's like to be a black man in the American South today. And the title comes from a quote from Harriet Tubman, the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad, born a slave, escaped to freedom in the North, risked her life to get hundreds of other slaves out along their secret network of safe houses that would get them to freedom in the North. And it's from her eyewitness description of a Civil War battle where a black military unit made a desperate assault on Confederate forces, unsuccessful, losing almost half their men. And she says, I'm going to read it, it's so beautiful. We saw the lightning, and that was the guns. We heard the thunder, and that was the big guns. And then we heard the rain falling, and that was the blood falling. And when we came to get in the crops, it was dead men that we reaped.
Oh, that makes me shiver.
It does. And yeah. I noticed that neither of us said, wow, for that one.
Yeah.
it's a moment of silence. And that's what it's like to be a black man in the American South. This over 5 years, here's what it's like. Over 5 years, Jessamyn Ward lost 5 men in her life, all violently. She called her book Men We Reaped. And this is the book about what she calls an epidemic, quite rightly. They all died basically because of who they were and where they were from, because they lived with history of racism and economic inequality, and the police circling black neighborhoods like vultures, the illegal strip searches, minimum wage jobs that offer no way up or out of poverty, and all of this leading to an erosion of personal and public responsibility that fosters the dissolution of family and relationships. And drug use, accidents, suicide become the stuff of daily life, as we see in these stories. So it is a memoir of these men, but she realizes that, I think she actually says this either in the prologue or towards the beginning of the novel, that it needs to be the story of a community. She points out, I'm pretty sure it was she, it might have been, my mind does play tricks on me sometimes, the difference between white people and black people in terms of what agency means, this word that's so fashionable nowadays and useful, not putting it down, but she says with white people, agency is your ability to affect your environment, and with black people, it's your community's ability. And in fact, in the book, she talks about her entire community and the problems that it has because of suffering from a lack of trust. And she says, you know, we didn't trust society to provide the basics of good education or good jobs or fairness and justice. And the culture that cornered, she actually calls it cornering us, which I thought was so apt. The culture that cornered us and told us that we were perpetually less. And it remains, the book is really a witnessing, not a call to action or an analysis. In fact, one of my favorite black writers, thinkers, essayists, Roxane Gay, criticized her for that. And she said, the prose is bursting with pain and beauty and truth, a book that everyone should read, but it doesn't do enough to rise above the grief. The culprits of these men's demise, being inextricably bound to race, is treated as assumption when it needs to be far more fully realized and plainly articulated. And I can see that. It was brought home to me really, where I really saw that was when I saw the book on Goodreads and all the little white faces on the profiles. The first line they said was, oh, this book made me cry. It was such a painful read, it made me cry. But I think Roxanne would say, don't mourn, get angry.
Yeah, and I'm so aware of my white privilege too, particularly reading this book, because it made me cry too. But it's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't want to lose your energy in tears, I think is what Roxanne Gay is saying. You know, crying is an outlet, and maybe it's better to not cry and to rage. But, yeah. I think everybody has to write how they lived it and what they know, and certainly, I think Jessamyn Ward is a younger writer and comes from a different place. And, you know, I want to say James Baldwin, two generations before, so she's born in the 70s, he was born in the 1920s. His grandfather was a slave. It's so hard to believe that a writer that I can pick up and read his books that don't seem at all antiquated was only two generations away from slavery. But again, speaking of white privilege, I should say that only hard probably for a white person to believe yeah. that his grandfather was a slave. And, of course, also because he was a genius, put that in. But he wrote something which I think he could have been speaking to Jessamyn Ward. He said, go back to where you started or as far back as you can. Examine all of it. Travel your road again and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or testify or keep it to yourself, but know whence you came.
What an amazing quote.
Yeah, I actually came across it because I recently reread Go Tell It on the Mountain, which is, I think it was his first novel. You can tell already from the title. We're back to those amazing titles. Go Tell It on the Mountain, Their Eyes Were Watching God, Men We Reaped. And it's an autobiographical story in which he's talking about his terrible relationship with his stepfather, who was a preacher, mean, I'm trying to think of another word besides mean, in the sense of beatings, constantly tearing him down, telling him he's ugly, marked by the devil. And the book is almost overwhelming in its intensity. It's the way it describes his loneliness and his desire with such eloquence. And, you know, James Baldwin actually was a child preacher for a period in his life. His stepfather was indeed a preacher, and he was a teen preacher. And he took issue, interestingly, with the so-called protest novel. So his book is a testimony. It's just like the testifying in church, and even to the same rhythms. And he asked, so I wrote this down, whether, speaking of protest novels, its power as a corrective social force is sufficient to override its deficiencies as literature.
What an interesting...
And he called social realism dogmatic and sentimental, and said that it does a disservice to, quote, the unpredictability and the occasional and amazing splendor of the human being.
Mm. Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it?
So it's
yes.
really good to get yes. different points of view yeah. on that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, speaking of different points of view, moving on to different books. So you've got...
So I've been reading The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, and this is a wonderful book as well. And as we were saying before, the Underground Railroad was an elaborate network of safe houses and safe routes across America, and it was used by enslaved African Americans to escape from the South, and they were heading to the free states in the North and also to Canada. And they do say that over 100,000 enslaved people escaped via this railroad. Now, on a personal note, I guess this is my white privilege coming through, but I've always been aware of the Underground Railroad, because it's known to have passed through a really small town in northern Indiana called Leoto. And this is the town I actually got married in. So I spend a bit of time in Leoto every couple of years. So when I'm there, I think about the Underground Railroad. So this book, it's about a young woman who's a slave on a cotton plantation in Georgia, and her name's Cora. Her life is hell. And a new arrival who becomes her friend tells her about the Underground Railroad, and they decide to embark on this really harrowing journey to try and get through the network and find true freedom. So this book, I really feel as though it's a masterpiece. It's interesting. It's a blend of history and fantasy. It's got elements of magic realism in it because Whitehead's Underground Railroad is in fact a true underground with tracks and hand powered carriages. So he is embroidering the truth a little bit. I think some people have called it an alternate history. And so it's just such a harrowing, tense and really terrifying tale, because Cora and her friend Caesar, all the time they're trying to outrun the slave catchers, the bounty hunters that made money by catching the slaves and returning them to where they came from on their, the terrible places that they were coming from. And there's this overwhelming sense of brutality running through the novel. But perhaps the standout moment for me is a quote that really actually ties in with Jesmyn Ward's writing. And I'm just going to read it. It's really quick. I've got the book here. And it says, it goes a bit like this. It says, "Here's one delusion that we can escape slavery. We can't. Its scars will never fade. When you saw your mother sold off, your father beaten, your sister abused by some boss or master, did you ever think you would sit here today without chains, without the yoke, among a new family? Everything you ever knew told you that freedom was a trick, yet here you are. Still we run, tracking by the good full moon to sanctuary." I thought that was really beautiful.
That is really beautiful.
And sad, and yeah, really, yeah. Really hard. So what I was just going to say really quickly, Colson Whitehead's new book, The Nickel Boys, just published. I've heard a lot of really great things about it, and commentators are saying that it's actually one of the best books of the year. So I can't wait to read that one.
Is that maybe for our summer vacation?
Yeah.
I think The Underground Railroad was Auckland Library's top 100.
Yeah.
And as was another book that I've recently read, which was, this little bridge here, Washington Black. Do you know about this book? By Essie Edugyan. I'm thinking
yes.
That's how you pronounce it. So this book is interesting. I read this after having read Jesmyn Ward, and I think in a way Jesmyn Ward spoiled a bit the book for me. It's beautifully written, and especially considering it's only the author's second book, she's a very young Canadian novelist. Her parents immigrated from Ghana to Canada. And the book follows the adventures of an 11-year-old slave. When the book opens, he's on a plantation, working on a plantation in Barbados, slaving on a plantation in Barbados, mm-hmm. not working, where he's unexpectedly given this chance to escape when the eccentric brother of the owner notices him, abolitionist, eccentric being including the fact that he's an abolitionist, notices him and takes him away with him because he has this ambition to build a flying ship. There's a bit of, it was interesting when you said alternate history, it's kind of a, not really sure if I call it alternate history, but it's funny because it becomes it's a captivating, as people call it. So it's got a little bit of everything. It's what you might call Dickensian if it wasn't if it didn't have a person of color as a hero, which sounds funny. I hope it doesn't sound too funny. But actually, you know, when he's 16, the ex-slave says, I needed to better my circumstances. I mean, is that a Dickensian line? Sounds like Pippin, Great Expectations.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
But it's just really stuffed. It's a big, thick book, stuffed with adventure, fantasy, romance, quirky science, traveling all around the world, and inspired by a true story. So I think it's a great book for a getaway weekend, or better yet, getaway 3 days. It doesn't have the strength or directness of Jessamyn Ward, whom I'd just been reading, as I said. And I don't think that's her intention in writing, though. It's not that there's no emotion. It's just that she's gone for the way the boy at one point describes love in the book. It's shadowy, and it's painful, and it's confusing.
Sounds great. I'm glad it's been written.
Well, you're glad. So, your getaway weekend.
Yeah.
And you don't have Colson Whitehead's new book. But a shorter one, so this one you can read without a getaway weekend, that I want to mention quickly is another great book that I read by a young, gifted, and black writer, is The Terrible by Ursa Daly Ward.
Oh, yes. Now, is this the British woman?
Yes. So, it's a complicated. Her mother was Jamaican and had gone to England to join her parents, who were already immigrated to England when she was 14, and they discovered that she was pregnant. And her father was a Nigerian student, not on the scene with them in Lancashire, but back with his other family. So Ursa Daly Ward comes out of the Insta poetry movement, but this is the book by which I think she showed that she has much more to offer than Instagram poetry. It is a memoir of this life that I've just from the premise that I've given you, I think maybe get an idea. But even better, I can give you a better idea with this wonderful epigraph which she writes in the front. It's a poem, and it says, "In love with how it happened so far, even the terrible things, and God, there were terrible things." And again, she wants to tell all her story, even the terrible things, which began when she and her little brother, whose name is Rue, in a very endearing moment in the book when she explains why he's called Rue, are sent to live with their fundamentalist religious grandparents when Ursa becomes an adolescent and her mother didn't trust her boyfriend around her, which is, as you can already guess, quite a terrible thing to hear your mother say. And then so she and Rue, tender Rue, sees things in the stars, and she feels things of the kind which her grandmother is always saying, cut the foolishness, is their first terrible change from their loving mother to the grandparents. And then she breaks out of that, and she has some new The Terribles, where she's barely managing to support herself working as a model and branches into being an escort, helped along by pills and powder. And eventually, though, she finds her voice, and it's a really sharp, perceptive, and invigorating honest. I'm not saying searingly, just admirably honest, and even funny at times. And she has this wonderful credo that she gives in the book. She shares with us this wonderful credo: your soul arises and you let it, or you don't.
That's beautiful, isn't it?
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And, you know, that quote makes me think of all the books we've talked about today. And there is really that feeling of souls arising. And also looking...
Still we rise.
Still we rise, yes. And looking to the stars. Really powerful writing that we've seen today, isn't it? And gosh, you know, it just makes me think so much about my own privilege in the world. Yeah. So look, this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing with me. Just a reminder that the books mentioned today will be on our show notes on the Auckland Library's blog, and that this can be accessed via the Auckland Library's website, which is aucklandlibraries.govt.nz. But it all can also be accessed via the Planet FM website, which is planetaudio.org.nz. So I guess this brings another show to an end. So until next time, happy reading, everyone. Haere rā and ka kite anō.
Ka kite anō. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond.
every day, every day, every day.